you know, the kind of skill that we do, the work we do, and I work on these lines ridiculously. People think I'm crazy, and I don't care, because they're infinitely perfectible. So you do all that work. It's like a dancer or a musician or an athlete. We do the scales. We do that, the breathing, the exercises, all this. And then you get out there, and, you know, hopefully all of that will allow the possibility of this happening. Now it takes you to be in the moment and really, and I'm not saying you're working on it as you're doing it, but there are times when I'm, you know, I know I'm not where I want to be, and I have the little voices in my head which just shut up, and listen. Just say the words. Just say the words.
Hi, and welcome to The State of Shakespeare. I'm Jim Elliott.
And I'm Garrett Vandermeer. And
today in the program, we have Jim DeVita. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on the program today.
It's great.
You've just gotten back in town, Jim. Where have you been?
Yeah, I've been in New York City. I've been at the Pearl Theater down on 42nd Street, and I just finished a month's run of my show. I have a show called In Acting Shakespeare, which is kind of a memoir play, but it's mixed with the story of Shakespeare and a hypothetical story of his life, and also mixed with a lot of Shakespeare pieces from his plays.
Where did you develop your acting aesthetic?
You develop it over years and years, to be honest with you. I mean, I had some great training. Most of my training when I went to school was very technical. It wasn't a lot about acting. It was about voice and speech and studying text and the art of rhetoric and trying to work on these sentences in Shakespeare that, you know, that can go on for 30 lines before you have a period. You know, how do you keep that subject aloft? But I've come to believe that the real chase that I'm after is this thing that I call it honesty, which is not a great word, because honesty to young actors can mean, they can equate that to be like small, like TV acting. And Shakespeare's language won't bear that. I mean, it's great. I mean, if you could do that on TV, it's wonderful, but we work in the theater. So the choices have to be larger.
Yeah, you trained at the PTTP up in Wisconsin, yes?
Yes, I did. First, I had 2 years of community college on Long Island, Suffolk County Community College, where I had two great teachers. I had one teacher, Richard Johnson, who was absolutely about technique and language and speech and the ideas of Shakespeare, the thoughts. And I had another mentor, Harriet Milvick, who was all about heart and realism and being honest.
It's a good combination.
Yeah, I started with those two people before I knew anything really about classical work at all. I was green. I was right off the fishing boats. But those two people are kind of the two thoughts that I still have in my head, still the thing that whenever I approach the roles, I try to work on that. It's not something you can just get. I tell young actors, it's not like you just get this and now you do this all the time. Every time you approach Shakespeare or a piece that we consider classical, you know, with a language is a language-based play, you will always be wrestling with this.
That's terrific. And I think one of the things that is impressive about that story is the longevity that you have taken in the approach to your training. And I know that as a teacher, I deal with a lot of students who just want to know how to do it now.
Yes, yes. If that was possible, you know, there'd be a book about it and we'd all be able to do it, you know. And I'm not being so humble. I'm serious. You never get this. You can't just get it. And all of the great actors know that. And we go out there every night and we try to do the best we can. I call it, you know, can I get the percentage higher of making that language clear and accessible and honest?
And your classical training, and it's really focused on body and voice. And how much of that is so important in when you're approaching the classical texts?
It is, absolutely. I mean, and we're always kind of interested, you know, where are the next generation of people that are training like this? Because there's, to be honest with you, there's not a lot of them out there. And I work in a 1,000 to 1,200 seat outdoor theater. And we get some people out here. And if you don't have the technique, the skills to do this, people get lost. They get eaten up. And it's not that they're not good actors. They can be great actors. So, but even just the technique of voice and body and speech, and which much of the contemporary work that we do does not call for that level of skill. It doesn't mean it doesn't call for skill. I mean, great acting and all that. But you're not trying to, you know, with dense imagery and metaphors and language that we have in, you know, some of these classical texts.
Could you give an example of an epiphany that you had working in that medium? Some key that you found?
Well, I've been guilty of just about everything that can go wrong while trying to speak Shakespearean text, because it is poetry. You can't get around the fact that it is poetry, which takes a certain knowledge to speak with an authenticity. I was very guilty when I first started out of what we call generalized acting. You know, as a young actor, I could be very authentic on stage. I could be really honest. I mean, I can make people really, really believe me. But in this medium of Shakespeare, they did not always understand what the heck I was saying. So we call it generalized acting. I think one of the epiphanies for me was working on Romeo when I was a young man. And if you're familiar with Romeo, you know the banished scene where Romeo, at the end of it, he's on the ground tearing his hair out. Any young actor will attack that. And in that banish it scene, we're saying, banish it, banish it, you know, this. And early in rehearsals, it's like, if I was an audience watching me, I would say, boy, Romeo's really upset. Over it. Now he's really, really upset. Oh my God, he's extremely upset now. So all we're getting are different levels of generalized upset, you know. But the language in that, where Romeo says something, it's like, flies may do this, but I from this must fly. And they may seize on the white wonder of dear Juliet's hand and steal immortal blessings from her lips, who even in pure and vestal modesty still blushes, thinking their own kisses sin, but Romeo may not. And he goes on to this amazing poetry. That imagery of flies landing on the lips of Juliet and they can kiss her, but he can't. You can't get that language clear if you're rolling on the ground screaming. And it's actually not honest. It's not authentic.
Right.
And when I got that, when the director came, you know, because I kept on saying, but I want to be honest. I want to feel this. He says, well, you're phony right now. Because there's no way your intellect could put together those kind of thoughts when you're upset like that. And when characters in Shakespeare are upset like that, he doesn't give you that kind of language. He gives you howl, howl, howl for King Lear. So I started to connect that, oh my God, I'm actually being phony by feeling upset, you know, making tears happen. I was actually being inauthentic because I couldn't think that well if I was that upset.
It's one of the things I always talk about is you cannot let the emotions override the words.
And I've heard that from day one, but it took me years to actually get that and believe it and kind of own it. And what I find out now, what I call writing the words, I call it being on top of the thought. That the thought is actually happening as you're saying the word. You're not behind the thought or the idea, and you're not in front of it. And when I land right on those words, more often than not, a genuine emotion will tap it, but it's nothing that I manufactured or tried to make happen or just generally, you know, emoted. And it usually surprises me. I can't plan it, and I can't do it the next night either.
So do you feel that being on top, that wonderful golden place of being on top of the words, is that something that an actor can control and can do at will, or is it something that an actor puts him or herself in a position of being able to make possible and then sort of hopes that it does on any given
I
night?
I think it's doing all the work, all the skill, and I often equate it to being an athlete, and some people don't like this because it doesn't sound like art, and I don't agree with that.
Oh, I love it.
I talk about Michael Jordan, okay? Michael Jordan, at his best, he was still there 2 hours early shooting free throws.
I always use the sports metaphor because not only what you just said, but your body has to be in tip-top shape, and you have to have that physical control that an athlete does.
Yeah, if your breath gets away from you, you know, if I start breathing and my breathing starts to get high in my chest and I lose my support for this language, I can't make it through those long thoughts, and then it starts getting away from you and ahead of you and I start rushing. Yeah, I use the Michael Jordan thing a lot. I say, in theater, we all want to be Michael Jordan when he's hitting, you know, 42 or 45 in his best games because he's in the zone. And that's what I call in acting. When everything is working, when the language is there and I'm honest, I'm really in the moment, you're in the zone. And it's just going. And as soon as you notice you're in the zone, you're out of it.
And all those hours in the gym, quote unquote, in the gym, have paid off.
Yeah, that's what has allowed that. When people just look at Jordan and say, oh my God, he's improvising there. You know, he's just going where the ball goes. You know, you can't touch him. It's magic. But it's magic that was allowed because of all those thousands of hours in the gym.
Absolutely.
Using metaphor, I want to be Michael Jordan in the zone every night. You want to not be Michael Jordan in the zone. Our bottom line still needs to be really, really good. So Michael Jordan on his worst day was pretty great.
Right.
So I talk about our bottom line where we fall back to technique. You know, we fall back to the skills that we learned, and which Michael Jordan would do too, and any athlete would do. Okay, you're not in the zone. Okay, fall back on your technique until you can get back in the zone.
You have chosen as your speech today, Gloucester from Henry VI, Part 3, Act 3, Scene 2. And what a fortuitous choice, given that Richard III's bones have just been discovered in a parking lot.
I know. I played this role once. I've directed the show once. And so I received about 20 emails from people around the country saying, did you see? Did you see they found Richard III's bones?
He died waiting for a parking spot.
I start my show with a cutting of this. And for 4 years, I'm still working on these first four lines of trying to get them as clear as I can.
So what's actually happening as this speech begins? Could you set the scene for us?
Yeah. Right before this, Richard's brother, Edward, who has just won the crown for him in one of the Wars of the Roses. But his brother is kind of a screw-up, and he's a ladies' man, and he's already abusing the power. He's going to marry this woman because he wants to bed her. And like these first four lines, he says, I, Edward, will use women honorably, as his brother is going out, you know, sarcastically or however you want to play that. But then these next three lines, we want to talk about imagery and how dense the language is. After he exits, then Richard says, "Would he were wasted, marrow bones and all, that from his loins no hopeful branch may spring to cross me from the golden time I look for." There's high poetry there. There's imagery there. And what we talk about a lot is, and what I try to do is, I'll take something apart, like, and this is about getting the detail of the language so specific in your mind that when you say wasted, you know what you mean by that. So wasted, marrow bones and all, what does that mean? And of course, to try and get that specific, what does wasted look like? You know, his brother, who was probably syphilitic because he slept with everything that moved and drank too much. So Richard is hoping that his body wastes away, literally, the marrow in his bones rots. Literally, that he falls apart, that from his loins, that from his, you know, his sexual organs, no hopeful branch may spring. So what is a hopeful branch? So the hopeful branch is not just the image of, you know, a branch. We can see the kind of the sapping, the idea of something growing, but a hopeful branch. He doesn't want him to have any kids that have the hope of getting the crown. A hopeful branch may spring to cross me. And if this branch, the metaphor there again, crosses me like this big tree falling down in front of him, to cross me from the golden time I look for. So what is a golden time? And golden time is, you know, Richard's time on the throne that he is looking for.
Right.
I mean, all of that is compacted in these three lines. And so the first thing is for me to understand and have imagery for that. I think in my head, literally have an image. You know, I hope his skin falls off and rots away so that his sexual organs fall off of him. So there's no way that he can impregnate anybody. So this other little thing might grow and get in my way from this golden time. And to get that as specific as I can in my mind, and then the next thing is, how can I say that I can communicate that to an audience?
Right.
Which is the harder thing sometimes, because a lot of us know what it means. We can give you a definition and look in the book and tell you everything about it. Now, can you say it that an audience who has never heard Shakespeare before will understand it? And that's the challenge.
That is a huge challenge.
What we're getting at then is that part of the craft and the secret of playing metaphor is to be as specific as possible in your own mind.
Mm.
Rather than trying to be every metaphor for everyone, making it specific for you, the actor, allows it to be specific for the audience. And it doesn't have to be the same image in their head. It cannot be the same image.
No. If it's done really well, it's not. But it's funny. We use the word specificity here ad nauseum. People will run screaming from the room because you want to be more specific with the language. And I keep finding out how I will think I'm being specific, and you can go one step further. I constantly find that. Because even a little, you know, three lines like that, you can get what we call, again, I said before, generalized acting. So you get a generalized sense that this guy wants something. But you don't get that I hope this guy's flesh falls off his bones, and you don't get that detailed imagery. And we also then don't get the story of that sentence. You know, we're basically storytellers. That's what we do. And you can take story from the arc of the entire evening. You can take a story to one idea like this in three lines. There's a little story in there.
Right.
I hope he wastes away and he never has any children and I get the crown. So we need to tell that story. We call it actually playing the metaphor literally. I don't know if you use that kind of language when you talk about Shakespeare, but my director out here, the artistic director, would say, play the metaphor. No, play it literally. Don't play an idea about the metaphor. Literally say, I hope the branch, you know, he says, get that image in your head, that branch growing that's going to get in your way, rather than just kind of a general sound over the metaphor. Do you talk about stuff like that?
Absolutely. And I think what's interesting about the metaphor, we talked about how the audience is going to get something different, but every actor is going to respond to a metaphor in a different way. And so what I talk about is how you need to be specific to yourself, not to what you think is right. And when you do that, you will get specific with the metaphor and with what you're doing on stage.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And that's why it's kind of infinitely perfectible. And there's, I think the depth of working on this is anybody that thinks they know how to do it, like there's a right way. I think there are ways that are clearer and more specific and more detailed. But if somebody says, you know, well, you just have to, you know, hit the meter here and hit the trochee and the spondee and this and that. But no, that detail, that specificity, like you're just saying, needs to come from some emotional connection, too, for each specific actor. Or you determine that between actor and director. And then when that actor connects to that emotionally or intellectually, which is completely unique to him or her, those words will sound different. They can't help but sound different. Yet we can still get the detail of Shakespeare's language and the poetry in there.
James DeVita, I'd love to hear more of this speech.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So right before this, Richard's brother, Edward, just says he's going to marry this woman. So he exits and Richard says, "Aye, Edward will use women honorably." And his brother leaves right after that. He turns to the audience and says, "Would he were wasted, marrow bones and all, that from his loins no hopeful branch may spring to cross me from the golden time I look for. And yet between my soul's desire and me, the lust web, which title buried, is Clarence, Henry, and his son young Edward to take their rooms ere I can plant myself. Why then? I did a dream on sovereignty. Well, say there is no kingdom then for Richard. What other pleasures can the world afford? I'll make my heaven in a lady's lap, and deck my body in gay ornaments, and witch sweet ladies with my words. And looks, the miserable thought, more unlikely than to accomplish 20 golden crowns. Why, love forswore me in my mother's womb. And, for I should not deal in her soft laws, she did corrupt frail nature with some bribe to shrink mine arm up like a withered shrub, to make an envious mountain on my back where sits deformity, to mock my body, to shape my legs of an unequal size, and to disproportion me in every part like to a chaos. And am I then a man to be beloved? Huh. Monstrous fault to harbor such a thought. Then, since this earth affords no joy to me, I'll make my heaven to dream upon the crown. And yet I know not how to get the crown, for many lives stand between me and home. And I, like one lost in a thorny wood, seeking a way and straying from the way, not knowing how to find the open air, but toiling desperately to find it out, torment myself to catch the English crown. And from that torment I will free myself or hew my way out with a bloody axe. Why, I can smile and murder whiles I smile, and cry content to that which grieves my heart, and wet my cheeks with artificial tears, and frame my face to all occasions. I can add colors to a chameleon, and set the letters not yet out of school. Can I do this and cannot get a crown? Tut, we're further off. I'll pluck it down.
Lovely read.
That was delightful.
I had to move around, and actually I have to move, so I'm walking around my office.
The first thing that I notice about this speech is how closely it mirrors the very, very famous opening lines of Richard III.
Now is the winter?
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, a lot of people often transpose part of this into it. It's kind of wonderful to read the Henry Sixes and to watch Shakespeare develop Richard of Gloucester from the young brother of these three brothers that are trying to get the crown with their father, York. And Richard slowly shows himself in those plays. And then finally, Henry VI, III, he steps up and has this amazing soliloquy.
What's really interesting is that it gives an actor unparalleled opportunity in Shakespeare that you get a history of a character on the page.
You're right. It kind of tells his entire history in this one speech.
If you're playing Richard III in that play, you can go back and read the Henry VI plays and get an understanding of where this guy comes from. And it's,
yeah, I just directed the show last year and working with the Richards, and we kept on going back to, Richard III is completely front loaded with the other three plays. So it was a great resource to keep going back to, and then the speech he has after he kills King Henry at the end of Henry VI's reign.
In this speech, which is, I think, the longest soliloquy in the canon.
Is it? I didn't know that.
Richard starts innocently enough, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And then he develops a metaphor at what would be line 32 in the speech. And I, like one lost in a thorny wood, he develops that metaphor for seven lines and ends with a bloody axe.
Yeah, I'll hew my way out with a bloody axe.
I wonder, is the metaphor the thing that inspires him to choose this murderous course? Is he so in the moment with his thoughts that at the beginning, when he starts actually seeking his way as one lost in a wood, is he in a completely different place than he finds himself eight lines later where he's resolved?
That's actually a wonderful director. You should direct me. I'd love to work with you as a director. Those are the great things to think, because what you'd love to do is that you don't know the end of the speech before you started. And the more you can, what we call, discover in the moment, the better. So you don't come on stage and report something that you already feel. Richard could actually be working through all these things, and these thoughts, these images, metaphors occur to him in the moment. And he gets the next idea in the moment. So I would agree with you. I would think that's really fruitful to work on as an actor and a director, because it's an obstacle. It's something actively to play as an actor that you don't just get in this general sense of the speech. So by making those decisions and playing that metaphor specifically, it's a little growing idea that actually grows in front of the audience and grows with the character.
And it gives you an opportunity to make the earlier part of the speech very much in the moment as well, particularly when he's talking about another course of action, which is to be a nice person, like in lines 12 through 14. 12 starts with, I'll make my heaven, and then goes on to describe his shortcomings physically, what is he doing there? Does he know where he's going with that? Or is he taking inventory and saying, well, I could do this, but then I have this, that, and the other thing, so I have to go in a different direction?
Yeah, I mean, the choice that I would make is that he doesn't, you know, he says, okay, this is not going to happen. Well, maybe I can make a great life with all the ladies and actually really entertain that thought rather than having it being sardonic and sarcastic already, like he knows that's not possible. Entertain the thought for real, which will have a different sound for an actor, a different cadence, and then realize, oh shit, what am I talking about? And that's that, oh, miserable thought. Who am I kidding? Of course, there's dozens and dozens of ways as far as tone that you can play when he's talking about his deformity. You know, it can be angry and mad at that, or it could be sardonic, or it could be lovely. It's like, look what happened to me. You know, you could be pleading. You can do anything you want with it. And that was how each actor will make that character completely different. Because that long line of thought ends with, you know, and am I then the man to be beloved? And that's a real question to the audience. Just listen, look at them and say, and is anybody going to love me like this?
And I think you'd lose something if you were to play that as a rhetorical question.
Yeah, of course, there may be exceptions to everything, but the less rhetorical you can make any of the question marks in Shakespeare, I think the better. Because as soon as you really ask a question, it changes the tone and the sound of the thought, the idea, and it makes it clearer for an audience too.
Yeah, I like to say that when you're asking a question, you're questing after information. Or an answer.
That's great, because it's a real clear, strong action for an actor to play. And either you're asking it from the audience or from, you know, the heavens or your brain or God or something. And I love Rich, because Rich is very much in the world of the Iagos. And
particularly that last section of the text, starting with line 39 all the way through to 44, reminds me very much of Iago. You know, he's almost smiling and saying, I can do all this, and I'm going to. And Iago does that all the time in Othello.
It's even Edmund in King Lear, not nearly as fully developed, but same kind of person that, you know, look at me and what I can do, and look at who's in power. Why should they be, and why shouldn't I be there? And I love these characters, because I've been fortunate enough to play them. And there's a wonderful relationship with the audience, where if you play this role right, they will enjoy you and go with you, until there's a point where they don't want to go with you anymore. And that's where the character continues on, and he leaves the audience behind, and usually the soliloquies go away after that. But the third villain I did, I noticed that.
Interesting.
And it's kind of fun. And, you know, it's usually, and with Richard, it's obvious in Richard III, when he kills the children, they don't want to play with you anymore after that. So you look at them and they turn away. And in the beginning of the play, they were laughing with you and smiling. And I think you need that too. You can't just play evil guy for 3 hours. There has to be something enigmatic and fun. And I'm not saying, you know, ha-ha fun. It's just some of his sardonic wit and his balls, the courage he has to do some of the things he does. And then he'll turn around in the audience and say, did you just see that? You know,
nice.
You know, and those are fun. Those discoveries are fun for Richard. In that way, you can take an audience along with you until you really get, you know, when you kill the kids and then they don't want to smile or laugh with you anymore.
That is fascinating. And I also like the point about playing evil, because as soon as you make that choice, you eliminate so many other choices and you won't even see them. So I think it's really great to look at it and find the humor, not haha like you were saying, but the actual idea of what humor is. And I think it's great because you open so many other doors that way, rather than just playing, I'm a bad guy.
Yeah, it's really a trap we all fall into, particularly when we start out in business. I fell into that trap when I was younger too, absolutely.
Well, it's fun.
It is fun, but I think it's the wrong story you want to tell, though. Eventually, you find it much more rewarding as you mature as an actor and play the other one. And then the evening will add up to an evil person, but you don't play evil from the top. You got to find out what this guy wants and how he's going to get it.
Jim DeVita, I have one last question about the text. The speech contains a lot of repetition.
Mm-hmm.
Lines 40 to 42 in your version all start with the word and. Right. How, as the actor, do you handle that repetition? And what advice would you give to younger actors when you see that?
Well, when we talk about things that can look like a list, and we kind of say, like, you don't want it to sound like a grocery list. And again, I don't think he knows he's going to say those three lines. And it doesn't mean pausing. It doesn't mean time. That's where I talk about being on top of the thought, that you're getting those thoughts as you're speaking them. So I can do this, and I can also do this, and then I remember that I can do this, and then I can also even do this if I want to. So it's like getting the action that's driving you through those thoughts. Like I said, not everything means actually taking a césure and then getting the idea, because that will bog a speech down. But sometimes that's not a bad thing to do early in rehearsal, though. You know, I can murder while I smile and take a beat there. Okay, what else can you do in rehearsal? Well, I can cry content of everything that grieves my heart. What else can you do? I can pretend to cry. I can do anything. And a lot of times we'll take those little césures early in rehearsal, and then we call it leaping and compressing. The director will say, okay, now leap and compress. That means take all those thoughts. The actor is connected emotionally and intellectually now. Compress it and just make that leap. And when you can do that, and it's in the moment, it's kind of thrilling for an audience too.
While you're staying on top of it and you're not taking a césure, you aren't necessarily speaking faster, you're thinking faster.
Yeah, it's both in the speeches and also in dialogue. When we say cue pickup, it just means get the thought quicker, that you're so engaged in the conversation that's happening that you're there with the thought already, which is hard to get. I'll err on the side of speaking too quickly sometimes too. So what's important in long speeches is finding out what's not important. What are the things that you can move through quickly to get to the real point that you want to make? I think the biggest mistake I make is wanting to stress everything and make everything important, because then nothing is important. Even in that first speech, it's across me from the golden time. It naturally slows down on the longer vowels on golden time.
And the consonants that extend as well. Time, mama.
Yeah. Because I actually called my coach in New York and I asked him to help me again with this speech, because those first three sentences, because what he will waste it. Sometimes we'll take it apart a little bit, like, so you could make marrow bones and all kind of a parenthetical, because you could say that thought, what he will wasted, that from his loins no hopeful branch may spring. So she said, make marrow bones and all a little less important, like a parenthetical. So what he will wasted, marrow bones and all, that from his loins, and go towards loins.
Right.
So that it's not all important.
James DeVita, thank you so much for joining us on the State of Shakespeare today.
It's been great. I'm kind of a geek about this stuff, too. It's kind of fun to talk to other people that have a similar vocabulary.
Thanks, James.
And it's been a pleasure. You guys are just great, and thank you for doing this.
I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And thank you for listening to The State of Shakespeare.
Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.